Welcome to Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, keeping you connected to your faith and your world. Teresa tackles the issues of faith and culture, the pro-life message, and media awareness. And now, here's Teresa Tomeo.
Well, good morning. Sherry Brownrigg in for Teresa Tomeo on Catholic Connection today. And on the show, what a great show we've got for you. We're going to be talking peace in the Middle East with Father Mitch Pacwa. Jeff Cavins visits later on this hour, and we'll talk about the refreshed Bible timeline study. You may remember that. That's been around for a very long time. Well, it's got some new features in it, and it is spectacular. Really, really something. And I apologize ahead of time. You can hear those allergies. I sound like I have an oath bitten on. Well, yes, it is October in the Midwest, and I'm telling you, it's reared its ugly head this morning. So I'm sure that I am not the only one in the U.S. suffering from that today. But we unite and take the medicine that we're supposed to take and have many Kleenexes with us all throughout the day. Hey, did you see that story yesterday about the Eucharistic procession in New York City? It didn't happen yesterday. I think it happened on Tuesday. But my goodness, what an incredible event that was. 5,000 people walking through the streets of New York. I almost said marching, but I caught myself because this was not a protest. It was adoration. Christ was present. There were bishops there. Oh, my goodness. And so many lay faithful just following the head of our church. And that, of course, is Jesus Christ. But can you imagine what that was like? The report from National Catholic Register said that as it spilled out onto Fifth Avenue, it must have filled the entire sidewalk. If you've been on Fifth Avenue, you know, the sidewalks are broad, but they're broad because there's a lot of people walking around in New York City. And it must have filled the entire sidewalks. But tourists were taking pictures and New Yorkers were stopping and staring. They probably have not seen anything like this before. And it was absolutely amazing. Isn't it just wonderful how our actions as Catholics really tell people what we think is important? 5,000 people following Jesus Christ in the public. You know, the actions that we take at Mass, how we treat Jesus in the Eucharist, how we receive Him, how we worship at Mass, that says so much when 70% of our fellow Catholics who go to Mass do not, well, not necessarily going to Mass. I think they actually talk to all Catholics, you know, whether or not they are going to Mass every Sunday or more, or they just are culturally Catholic and say, yeah, I'm Catholic, but yeah, I really don't go to Mass anymore. They asked all of them, and 70% of that wider group does not believe that Jesus is truly present in the Eucharist. They've just forgotten it or never believed it in the first place, many different reasons. But imagine what that tells them, how we act in Mass. When we're out in public and we are at a restaurant, how we pray before meals. That says so much. I've had servers who have stopped and just really, really smiled just broadly. They've stopped because they were serving us. Oh, they're praying. Okay. And that says a lot. Even if it makes us uncomfortable sometimes, well, it's really wonderful that we can actually express that. And you know, the older I get, the more my faith grows and the more that I have a growing devotion to the Eucharist and realize how important it is to show that I truly believe. And I'm on the liturgy board at my parish, and so that means I do a lot of jobs at Mass. One of them is as a Eucharistic minister, and I love it because I pray. I have the opportunity to pray for each and every person who comes forward to receive Jesus. And it's a really, really beautiful thing when you can tell someone is really eager to receive Him. They're not looking at me, they're looking at Him. And then you can tell when there are those who don't necessarily know who they're receiving or that they are receiving a person, and that is Jesus Christ. And you can really, really pray for them and minister to them, not with your words, but with your actions. Actions mean a lot, and they are so important. as what we do with our lives as Catholics. And I thought about that after I saw that Eucharistic procession. Would people know that I'm Catholic by my actions? Well, I certainly hope so. I know my team at work, I run a classical music station, and I don't have any active Catholics on my team. I have some lapsed Catholics, but, you know, the way that I treat them, I try to let Christ love them through me and help them through me. And, you know, that's certainly something I do at home, too. I'm not perfect, but I'm trying. So I love the fact that we can try together. And let's tell the world that we are Catholic, that we love Jesus, and that he is our King. Well, it's getting close to 6 minutes past the hour wherever you are listening, and it is time for news. Peace in the Middle East is fragile as Hamas says it has returned to Israel the bodies of all the hostages that it can. Blake Sifton reports from Tel Aviv that Israel is not accepting that explanation.
Defense Minister Israel Katz has threatened to resume fighting if Hamas does not honor the ceasefire deal, saying he ordered the military to prepare a plan to crush the group if the war restarts.
Hamas contends it has abided by what was agreed upon and has handed over all the living captives in its possession and the corpses it could access. The ceasefire agreement calls on the Palestinian militant group to turn over the remains of 28 deceased hostages within 72 hours. Only 9 bodies have been returned so far. Hamas says it would take significant efforts and special equipment to recover the remaining bodies from the destruction in Gaza. Meanwhile, Cardinal Pierre Battista Pizzaballa has given an update on the status of Christians in Gaza. "We are in daily contact with them," the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem said of the Catholic community in Gaza in a Vatican News interview. "They keep writing that they still cannot believe they were able to sleep through the night without hearing the sounds of bombs." Despite the promising outcome of the first phase of the peace deal, which saw the return of Israeli hostages and the strategic withdrawal of IDF troops from Gaza, Pizzaballa emphasized that the situation in Gaza remains very fluid. Amid de-escalation between Israel and Hamas forces, clashes among warring factions have broken out across Gaza. "The situation remains dramatic because everything is destroyed," he explained. "People are returning, but they are returning to the ruins. Hospitals are not functioning. Schools do not exist. There is still the matter of the bodies of the deceased Israeli hostages that must be recovered." Congressional maps across the U.S. could be impacted by a Supreme Court hearing Wednesday. Mark Mayfield has the story.
Justices heard arguments over whether Louisiana's new House map violates the Constitution. The 2024 map created a second majority black congressional district after black voters sued, arguing the old map violated the Voting Rights Act because they were being underrepresented. The state's attorney general says the part of the Voting Rights Act that prohibits racial discrimination in redistricting is unconstitutional. I'm Mark Mayfield.
Bank of America and the Bank of New York Mellon are being sued for allegedly knowingly providing financial services that enabled Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking operation. They're being sued by a woman who said she was abused by the late sex criminal. The suit filed Wednesday alleges that the plaintiff met Epstein in 2011, became financially dependent on him, and was abused at least 100 times. She claims that she was employed on paper by a sham company and told to open a Bank of America account in which money was regularly deposited. The Bank of New York is accused of providing credit to a modeling agency Epstein used to traffic victims. President Trump is killing the multi-billion-dollar Gateway Rail Tunnel project in New York. Scott Pringle reports.
The project, which has already started, will add a commuter rail tunnel underneath the Hudson River between northern New Jersey and Manhattan. President Trump with a surprise announcement on Wednesday.
Project in New York, it's billions and billions of dollars that Schumer has worked 20 years to get. It's terminated. Tell him it's terminated.
New York Democratic Senator and Minority Leader Chuck Schumer responded, saying Gateway is the most important infrastructure project in America, and that Trump trying to kill it again is pure spite and stupidity. It's unclear if Trump took formal action to remove federal grant funding for the project. Scott Pringle, NBC News Radio, New York.
The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops will select a new president and vice president during its fall plenary assembly, which is set for November 10th to November 13th in Baltimore, Maryland. In November, the three-year terms for the current president, Archbishop Timothy P. Broglio, and vice president, Archbishop William E. Laurie, are set to expire. The new conference leaders, who will be chosen from a slate of 10 candidates, will also serve three-year terms. After the president is chosen, the vice president will then be selected from the remaining nine. Measles cases continue to rise across the U.S. Jim Roop has more.
Cases are at a record high in the United States. The U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention says there have been an average of 27 new cases each week since the end of August. So far this year, the CDC says there have been 44 outbreaks. There were just 16 all of last year. The annual total is now above 1,500, the highest since measles was declared eliminated in the U.S. in 2000. I'm Jim Roop.
Instagram is putting guardrails on what teens can see on its app. Instagram CEO Adam Mosseri was on the Today Show to explain.
What we're announcing today is that we've revamped all of our guidelines about what teens can and cannot see on Instagram, in a way that is guided by the PG-13 rating that was pioneered by the movie industry.
Mosseri says using the PG-13 rating as a guide, teens will be limited to sexualized content or other similar material deemed inappropriate. The changes apply only to teen-specific accounts. He also says the new guardrails won't be perfect.
You will occasionally come across content that it might be risky because we either missed it or because it was said by a friend. But generally, there is a lot more restrictions on what you can't see.
Other apps, such as YouTube, have also rolled out similar methods to restrict inappropriate content to teens. The J.M. Smucker Company is taking Trader Joe's to federal court, Michael Kastner reports.
We were torn apart at birth.
That's dramatic.
This is the story of the best part of the sandwich and his crust.
Smucker is filing suit against the grocery chain over concerns that Trader Joe's new frozen peanut butter and jelly sandwiches are too close in design and appearance to Smucker's Uncrustables. Smucker suggests that even the box that the Trader Joe's sandwiches come in is similar to theirs. Smucker wants restitution and all of the Trader Joe's packaging and sandwiches to be destroyed.
So I said, no, you're the one who's jelly.
Yeah, hilarious.
I'm Michael Kastner.
And did you know that St. Hildegard of Bingen is responsible for your favorite pumpkin spice drink? Well, not exactly, but Church Pop reports that she actually brought the combination together that makes up pumpkin spice, which is a blend of all those spices, cinnamon, clove, and nutmeg. And today we call that pumpkin spice, but what she called it was simply healing. This is what she said about it. It will calm all bitterness of the heart and mind, open your heart and impaired senses, and make your mind cheerful. And isn't that what we think about pumpkin spice? I love that. Lots more to come on Catholic Connection. Father Mitch joins us, and we're going to be talking about that fragile peace in the Mideast, and Jeff Cavins later on this hour. So I hope you stay with us right here on Catholic Connection. Welcome back to Catholic Connection. Sherry Brownrigg today in for Teresa Tomeo. And this is the time of the week, the time of the show when we welcome Father Mitch Pacwa to the program. And of course, we have to talk about that fragile peace in the Middle East, because that's really heavy on our hearts as we awake on this Thursday morning. Father Mitch, first of all, welcome, as always.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I hope you all are doing well.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. It's very fragile. You know, there are still contentions, and honestly, it looks very tenuous at this point. What do you think about what's happening in the Middle East today?
I don't know you very well, and I'm not aware that you ever raised any children. But
no, unfortunately, no.
Yeah. I mean, I've only raised other people's children by teaching, so I have my own distant. But having been at times called a recalcitrant child by Mr. and Mrs. Pacwa, I think that there is the kind of reality that Hamas does not want to give up power. This is what all of their the native other Arab and Muslim countries, because many most Muslims are not Arabs, and the largest Muslim country is Indonesia, and India is right up there too, with quite a few hundred, way more than the Arab countries. But so a number of non-Arab Muslim countries, as well as the Arab countries, were very clear in telling Hamas they have to give up, but they don't want to. They don't want to give up their weapons. They don't want to surrender. They started a war they could not finish, and they brought great levels of destruction through this war. And then you have to keep another element in mind, and this is so it's not only the recalcitrance of Hamas. But there's also another factor. The Hamas and many other people in Palestine really hate the Israelis. The Israelis sometimes, there are plenty of Israelis who also have a furious hatred back. There's mutual rejection and hatred going on. And both communities have a certain amount of, you know, justification for getting back at each other, because they both hold, as a religious principle, that an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. It's in the Old Testament. It's in the Quran. There are plenty of folks also on both sides who recognize that if you keep going for an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, that you will just end up with both sides being toothless and eyeless, blind and only able to gum their teeth. There are plenty of people on both sides who see that, but there are also individuals on both sides who want revenge and will do what they can to achieve it. This is a tough thing to deal with, and in one sense, and I use the right now, I would say that the primary problem is coming from Hamas. They're the ones who are, executing Palestinians publicly on the street. Anybody who cooperated with Israel during the occupation, and I don't, and this is where Hamas is, by not only modern democratic standards, but also by other standards, including Islam, in Islam. You know, what criteria? What kind of courts are these? These are my impression is that these are kangaroo courts, such as we've seen in past totalitarian governments. And Hamas is being cruel, and they do, because of their own approach to total destruction of their enemy. Israel, and got to keep this in mind. Israel does, or at least most, the vast majority of Israelis, there is a small group of folks within Israel that would want to see the destruction of the Palestinians. But that's not by any stretch a majority of Israelis. It's a small group that I think Israel has made illegal because they're mad as hatters. But Hamas are mad hatters. Mm. They also want to see the destruction of their enemies, and they are willing to use death and and this totalitarian oppression to get what they want. They're out of control. These would be folks who began very much as a religious group, and
Hamas did.
Yes, Hamas is an offshoot, and I want to emphasize offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, and which was a group in Egypt. It started in Egypt. The inspiration for it came from a man in the 1920s when the British were still basically in charge of Egypt. They had taken it from the Turks. And Egypt's history is complicated, but especially after 1921, when Kemal Ataturk overthrew the caliph in Istanbul. The caliph was the religious leader of Islam. And in the Turkish Empire, which was the largest empire. And he was the only one with legal authority to decree a fatwa, that is, a religious decree to destroy, to kill people who offended God and Muhammad and Islam, and for a few other things too. And the Sultan could not do it. The Sultan was the military leader, and the caliph was the religious leader. That was abolished. Both the Sultanate and the Caliphate were abolished. And so in Egypt, a movement known as the Salafi were people who said, we can declare our own jihad. There is no caliph, so we declare jihad. And that developed into the Muslim Brotherhood, as an ideology, and then a political movement. The Egyptian government opposed them, arrested them, expelled them from Egypt, etc. But they inspired the Hamas movement. And they have that sense, we can declare the death sentence for our enemies. We can declare jihad. We can do this. And they won't let go of that. And at this point, they are completely unwilling, it's from external observance, they're unwilling to let go of absolute power. And the only way for peace in Gaza is for them to do so.
Father Mitch, I have so many questions, and we'll have you back in the next segment, so we look forward to that. And you listening right now, aren't you learning a lot from Father Mitch? It's wonderful. We'll be back in just a minute. It's Catholic Connection. Sherry Brownrigg in for Teresa Tomeo this morning. And we have Father Mitch Pacua with us on Cultural Connections, talking about peace in the Middle East. And Father Mitch, like all the listeners out there, I'm sure I just am learning so much about how this conflict came to be. And I know it's a very, very deep subject. You mentioned a couple of things in the last segment when we were talking about this, that how Hamas sees Israel as their enemies. But right now, what's happening is they're trying to regain or actually hold on to control in Gaza, and they're actually killing other Palestinians in the streets, executing them. So let's put the two together. So clearly they are seeing these Palestinians as their enemies.
Yeah, there's no doubt of that. They clearly see anybody who opposes them as their enemy. And this is, you know, extremely dangerous for everybody involved. And one of the realities is that at some point, the, you know, for instance, President Trump has said, look, y'all gave your word that you would, you know, respect these agreements and give up your power. You would give up your weapon. You agreed to that. And at this point, you have a moral obligation to do so. And they really don't want to.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the United States and Israel will see to it that there is a reckoning. You know, there's no way around it. They can't afford to be fooling around. You know, and so, because, again, it's not only Israeli lives, it's also Palestinian lives. I mean, these are just, they're acting as bad players. And if their word means nothing, then more responsible powers will take on the issue and attack them. That's just, I'm talking about not what anybody thinks should or could be. I'm talking about the reality of the situation.
And Israel has already said they would do that if Hamas.
Of course they did.
Yeah.
And here's something that, you know, keep in mind. There's no way that I would blame them for doing that. These are people who have decided to do grave evil. They harm the people of Israel and Palestine. You know, this is why would you trust such people to do those kind of things? This is a horrendous and grave wickedness. You just can't allow this lawlessness on the international, because it has these horrible effects on the people of Israel, on the people of Palestine. I mean, who doesn't suffer for this? This is one of the things that happens with corrupt government. When governments become corrupt, they are, you know, and no longer serve the people. They bring about great evil for everybody. You can't afford to have that happen. That's the flat reality. And so, and you made an agreement. Your word needs to mean something here. And if it does, you know, in the Middle East, giving your word still has a lot of significance. They gave their word, and they have to act on it. Right? That's going to be the flat reality.
And Father Mitch, not only did they say that they would give up their arms, but they also said that they would return the hostages, those living, and then the remains of those who are no longer alive.
Well, that's right. There's no way for us to know here whether they are able to return those hostages or not. We just cannot know that.
Yeah.
You know, that's something that is out of the, you know, they may not. I mean, you look at Gaza and the place is rubble. Well, it's horrendous what's happened there. And as a result, you know, how can they, you know, find, you know, some of these people? But they have to work, and it would be good if some of the other states would, with better equipment, would try. Now, they brought the remains of somebody who was not Israeli to play here. They, did not have the, the right remains. And the reason for that is, they may not even have known that that is really feasible. They had no clue who the person actually was. I would not be one bit surprised at that. But they don't know DNA. I mean, but the Israelis do. The Israelis are truly brilliant. These are people who know science, medicine, and if you think you're going to fool them, you have another thing coming. They will not be tricked and fooled. The Israelis are not in any way fools. And they better have that clear. That's partly what made the horrors of the attack on Israel so bad to begin with. They took on a fight in Israel that they could not possibly win. There was no way for them to be successful in this war. How wickedly dumb. I would not go and try to attack Hulk Hogan. This would be a fatal mistake. Now, if he were alive. But, or that Irish kickboxer and all that. Mm-hmm. There's no way that I would start such a thing because I could not finish it. You don't start a fight you can't finish.
Well, Father Mitch, thank you for being with us today, and thank you for helping us to understand this situation more than we can get on the news. And Father Mitch will be back next Thursday on Cultural Connections, and we have more to come on Catholic Connections, so don't go away. Catholic Connection, and I'm Sherry Brownrigg in for Teresa Tomeo today. I hope your day has started out well. We've got the pleasure right now of welcoming Jeff Cavins to the program. We're going to be talking about, I guess, what we call the Refresh Bible Timeline Study, and I've had a chance to look at it, and it is absolutely fabulous. And Jeff, I feel like you don't really need an introduction for most people. Maybe what I could say is that Jeff Cavins is everywhere you turn, which is a good thing, and few people can communicate their love for Jesus Christ with as much zeal and clarity and enthusiasm as you, Jeff. So thank you for all that you do for the church.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me on the show. It's great to talk to you. You and I have been friends for almost 25 years or so or more.
I know. And it's amazing because we were just 12 when we met, and so young now.
I was four.
Oh, me too. But Jeff, I'm glad you brought that up because I remember learning about the Bible timeline when you and I first met and being amazed at how it could knit together Scripture in a way that made it so understandable. And you have actually been improving it for these past 25 years. And now there's a refreshed version that's coming out. And we'll talk about what's different and what's new about it for those who who have been using the Bible Timeline study at home, in churches, etc. But the very first question that I have is, you know, we Catholics are accused of not really knowing Scripture. So maybe I've already answered this question, but why is it important that we study Scripture?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. The basic question is to where the Bible fits into our life as Catholics. I would say, well, first of all, it's our book. It came from the tradition of the Church at the very beginning and was cared for through apostolic succession down through the years and interpreted by the Church down through the years. So every group of Christians in the world today, they have traces of Catholic theology and decisions that have been made throughout the years, no matter what denomination they belong to. But I think that to answer the question, why should we be studying the Bible, it's because it's a revelation. It's a revelation of two things. One, who is God? What's his plan? And the second is who we are and how do we fit into his plan? And so as we study it, we are encountering the big problem at the beginning with Adam and Eve, and then the prolonged solution the climax of the entire story being Jesus and his fulfillment of everything that went before him. So I think that's really the answer. It reveals God, it reveals who we are, gives us a plan for our life.
Yeah. And it also prepares us to share that plan with others, yeah, to help them to understand where they are in God's plan. How does studying the Bible help us do that?
Well, that again, that's a great question. That makes me think that oftentimes people don't share God's plan for their life. They share scriptures. They share individual little truths or little sayings or a quote here and there. But if you can't tie it all together into a story, then it doesn't benefit people as much. I mean, look at, for example, we were talking about The Wizard of Oz, the movie. If I went around the country and just did a seminar on ruby slippers, and I did another seminar on how to kill a witch with water, you know, or whatever it might be, people would say, wow, that's really interesting. You know, Jeff has a great talk on ruby slippers, but they have no idea how the ruby slippers fit into the entire story or what Kansas is or Toto or the Scarecrow, you know. And so when it comes to sharing all of this with other people, we've got to remember that it's more than sharing a verse. It's sharing a person with a story connected to it where you are the object of his love and his care. That's the key right there.
It also seems like that is absolutely the key to the Bible timeline, the way that it's constructed. You know, you hear a lot of people say, oh, I read the Bible from cover to cover. And I've tried to do that before, but it's really hard to know how this book fits in with that book, this story knits in, and how it foreshadows this story here in the New Testament. How does the Bible timeline tie everything together into one story of our salvation?
Right. And well, the Bible timeline, what I did at the very beginning was I had a hunger to do what you just said, and that is to know the whole story and how it all fits together. I too read the Bible cover to cover like three or four times in my 20s, and I could not tell you the story. I could tell you stories, but not the story. So what I did is I took the entire Bible, and we don't mess with the order of the books. I don't think that's a good thing to do. But what I did do is I divided up the entire Bible into 12 historical periods, color-coded. And then I went back into the Bible and found the narrative books. What are the books that actually tell the story or keep the story moving? And I came up with 14 of those. And then there's 59 other books that are not narrative, like Psalms and Proverbs and the Prophets and Ecclesiastes and Ruth and Leviticus, you know, and Deuteronomy. So what I did is I placed those 59 books in the 12 periods and where they belong in the 14 narrative books. So essentially you have a visual look at the entire story of salvation history with every book where it belongs in the narrative. Once I did that, man, I was off to the races. I was so excited. I created this big chart and I carried it around with me all the time. I put it out on the table, and I studied the Bible that way. It was really just for me, and that's really the truth. I created it just so I would know the story and I could teach better. And then when I started showing other people that chart, they were like, whoa, how do I get a copy of that? And I realized I stumbled, because of my weakness, onto something that other people needed to hear.
That's just absolutely phenomenal. That's one of those stories that you can see God in it along the way, in all parts of it, and, you know, how he moved you to create that. And for yourself, you know, sometimes those are where the best inventions actually happen, is our hunger, our own hunger. And that's really beautiful. Well, and you also do the Bible in a Year podcast with Father Mike Schmitz and do a lot of different projects with him. Mm-hmm. And that has, I think, every year been voted the top podcast, top Catholic podcast. And, you know, it's so popular. And I actually have used that as well. And it's just an absolutely incredible, incredible podcast. I love the format of it. But how do those two things tie together?
Well, what we did back when we started the Bible in a Year podcast, Father wanted to do something daily. And we all got together and thought, well, if we want to go through the Bible, let's don't do it the regular way. Let's don't do it in the way that it's written, you know, with the order of the books, because, again, we're going to land people in that problem area of, I don't know the story, but I heard those stories, and that was interesting. So we took the three-month reading program of The Great Adventure, which is reading four chapters a day of the 14 narrative books, and you'll read through the Bible in 3 months. So what we did is we used that as a skeleton, and then we laid down all the rest of the Bible in its proper place and went through it from Genesis to Revelation that way. And Father did the daily. And then I would come in and I would be like a trail guide. And I would say, okay, we're going to move into a new period now. Here's where we came from. Here's where we're going. Here's where people get messed up, you know. And then we would proceed from there. And I don't think anybody had any plans of that podcast doing what it did. In fact, when it came out on that January, I forgot about it. I mean, you know how it is. You do things and then you move on to something else and you forgot it's coming out. And my producer called and said, are you sitting down? And I said, yeah. She said, you're number one in the country. And I had absolutely no idea what she was talking about. None.
Wow.
None. And I said, what? And she said, podcast, Bible in a Year. And I said, was that Catholic? You know, and she said, no, all the categories. And both Father and I said, you got to be kidding. And we looked on Apple and saw it and realized, the first thing we both realized, Sherry, was the Holy Spirit is behind this.
This is
the Holy Spirit. That was the first thing we really recognized, because we said, had we known that that would be a goal, we would have not done that format. We would have tried to be funny or something, you know.
You know, and that is the problem with us, isn't it? That you got to get yourself out of the way and let the Holy Spirit work. Sometimes God hides those things from us so that he can be the one to really speak, you know, and it's easier for us to get ourselves out of there. But why do you think that the Bible Timeline and the Bible in a Year podcast have been so popular?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. One is that the times that we're living in now, and I say now meaning the last 10 years or so, are very confusing. The institutions, the truths, the social norms that we have relied on since we were kids growing up have changed rather quickly, and things are very confusing, and they're fluid, they're changing, and men, women, marriage, everything. And so I think one of the reasons is that people are looking for something solid that doesn't change, in something that is dependable, and of course that's God and his word. And I think that there is a moving back to truth. And so, for example, 46% of Gen Zers are going to church every week now. And the rise, and it's up towards 60%. Young men are now returning to the Catholic Church, of all churches, the Catholic Church. And so I think it says something about tradition, truth, tradition in terms of the faith, tradition in terms of the family, marriage, and so forth. And I think that the world is tired and worn out with all of this political problems and all the social rhetoric, and they have returned. I also think that a lot of this is due to the fruit of John Paul II, to be honest with you, and that what the foundation that he laid, and Pope Benedict, and I think that the people who were changed by their ministries have grown up and are involved in ministries and working at EWTN, you know, in other places, and I think that they have a hand in this. But then the third thing is, for particularly the Bible in a Year podcast, people were at home, locked in, empty, uncertain, and suddenly we come face to face with them and say, I promise you, if you go through this, you're going to understand the story for the first time in your life. I promise you that. We're going to lay it out so that you will understand God's plan for your life. I think that the context of the introduction of the Bible in a Year podcast had something to do with it. That is the atmosphere at the time.
Wow. Well, Jeff, we have less than a minute, which makes me very sad, and I want to tell people that you can find the Refresh Bible Timeline Study from Ascension Press. Can you tell us in just a few sentences what's new about it?
Yeah, the new one is I go to these places. I'm on Mount Sinai. I'm in Jerusalem. I'm in Rome. I'm in Greece. And we are representing the entire story. I have 8 other teachers joining me. And we're on location and in studio, and it's new graphics and everything. It's really exciting. We're going to bring you to Mount Sinai to talk about the Ten Commandments, and it doesn't get better than that.
No, it doesn't get better than that. And I know that this study is for everyone, right? You can study individually, parishes, homeschooling groups. Is that correct?
That's right. Yep. Even a parish can have 4 or 5 going on at different times.
Yeah, and they can be in different segments of it. Well, Jeff Cavins, thank you so much for letting the Holy Spirit work in you and creating this. We are so excited. Again, it's available from Ascension Press, the Bible Timeline Study. It's refreshed. Go find out. And we'll be back on Catholic Connection. Catholic Connection, Sherry Brownrigg in for Teresa Tomeo. Coming up tomorrow, Vanessa will be in for Teresa, and she'll have Doug Keck with the Inside Word. Joseph Pierce will be talking about great books for good men as well. Boy, that sounds interesting. Wasn't it just an incredible first hour of the show? I tell you, it's Father Mitch Pacwa is just absolutely amazing, helping us to really understand that you know, that there's a lot happening there in the Middle East that we need to take to prayer. Sometimes I think it's really an inclination, okay, for me, I don't want to hear about the news. I don't want to hear about the chaos. I try not to pay attention because, honestly, it disturbs my peace greatly. But this is one of those things I think we all need to keep abreast of so we can pray for it. And let's definitely do that. And talking with Jeff Cavins about the Refreshed Bible Timeline, wow, I am really excited to get into that and to study all the more, and the ability to go to some of those wonderful places. Just absolutely amazing. Hey, coming up next on EWTN Extra, we'll be talking with Chris Ferrara, who is Senior Counsel at Thomas More Society. And the topic is about this incident. There was a Catholic pro-lifer, Savannah Anteo, and she was physically attacked while filming a woman in the street interview in New York. And Chris has been defending her, and we'll find out what that is all about. So much left on EWTN here. And Sherry Brownrigg, stay with us on Catholic Connection.
Welcome to Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, keeping you connected to your faith and your world. Teresa tackles the issues of faith and culture, the pro-life message, and media awareness. And now, here's Teresa Tomeo.
Good morning, Sherry Brownrigg in for Teresa Tomeo. And happy to be here today. It's Thursday, almost wrapping up this week. And this hour of the show, you get to hear Teresa, an interview that she did with Michael New, talking about abortion rates declining. Yay on that. And also Katrin Bennett will be here and talking about the book Holier Matrimony. So that's really going to be fun. And then we'll be back after and talk with Chris Ferrara, senior counsel at Thomas More Society, about the case of a young pro-life woman who was filming a woman in the street interview in New York and was physically attacked. Yeah, my goodness. I tell you, there's a lot out there, isn't there, friends? And I'm excited to hear what's happening with that. Some of it is not good, but some of it is good. So we'll hear from Chris about that. And today's the feast of Saint Hedwig. Silesia, in what is now Germany, that's where she was born and married to Prince Henry I, and both of them practiced great works of charity and piety. They founded many monasteries, founded an order of sisters. And it's also, I think, maybe more, I wouldn't say popular, but more well-known today. It's the feast of St. Margaret Mary Alacoque. And of course, she is famous for the church's devotion to Jesus's Sacred Heart. Other saints, to be clear, promoted it before her, but it was her visions and her determination and her just will that said, all right, Lord, I will do whatever it is that you want me to do, that gave us the first Friday devotions and really holy hours. Yeah, she was the one who came up with that initially. And that, of course, was she didn't come up with it. Jesus came up with it. But she was the one who said, this is Jesus, what Jesus wants us to do. And that has become widespread practice in parishes around the world. And St. Margaret Mary was always devout. She consecrated herself to Mary at a really young age, promising to enter religious life. But when she was about 17, so the story is that her family, they didn't have great wealth, but they had enough to be active in society and, you know, doing different things like that, participating in society. And when St. Margaret Mary's father died, there was a relative that refused to give the assets to St. Margaret Mary's mother and her sisters. So they were very, very poor. And once they were able to reclaim those assets, well, St. Margaret Mary's mother was probably, understandably for the age, kind of worried about Margaret finding a husband. So at 17, her mother asked her to become more social in the hopes that that would happen. And St. Margaret Mary did that. Her name was Margaret. She adopted the Mary as part of her name after consecrating herself to Mary. But she was out at a dance and she had a ball gown on. I'm sure she was very beautiful, done up. And on the way home, Jesus appeared to her, and he was in his crucified form, battered, bloodied, and told her that she'd forgotten about him. And of course, can you imagine having that vision? It would just, I think, move you to the very depths of your heart. There would be no way that you would be different after that. Well, St. Margaret Mary remembered that she had told Mary when she was young that she was consecrated to her and that she would become a sister. And Jesus reminded her of that vow. And so she did. That's just absolutely amazing. I love the saints, and I love how we sometimes have trouble explaining the saints and our love for them and how they work in our faith to those outside the church or even outside Christianity. I remember once getting a Catholic radio station started, we had a beautiful altar, and it had a small first class relic of St. Luke in there. We had a computer gentleman who helped us with all of that, and he was not a Christian. And I was giving him a tour of everything around the station, and I mentioned that about the altar. And he said, so are you telling me that that's part of his body is in there? Yes. When he asked it that way, I paused for a moment, and I thought, well, that is kind of weird to those who don't realize that, that that's something for us that is so absolutely wonderful that we could actually have a part of a saint's body to venerate, that we would have a part of them. And, you know, that was something that, that happened early on. People were really grasping all the time at, well, at holiness. They didn't have much. We have so much more today. And that meant so much to them. If they could get a little sliver of someone who is holy, perhaps maybe that would help them to be holier and would just help them in general. You know, many reasons for that. But I finally did explain to him why that was so important for us and how it helped us in our faith walk. And I'm not sure whatever happened to that young man, but, you know, the saints allow us the opportunity to really delve deep into our faith and to model our lives after them, and also to help others explain the faith and to understand it. And now, about 6 minutes past the hour, it is time for news. Peace in the Middle East is fragile as Hamas says it has returned to Israel the bodies of all the hostages that it can. Blake Sifton reports from Tel Aviv that Israel is not accepting that explanation.
Defense Minister Israel Katz has threatened to resume fighting if Hamas does not honor the ceasefire deal, saying he ordered the military to prepare a plan to crush the group if the war restarts.
Hamas contends it has abided by what was agreed upon and has handed over all the living captives in its possession and the corpses it could access. The ceasefire agreement calls on the Palestinian militant group to turn over the remains of 28 deceased hostages within 72 hours. Only 9 bodies have been returned so far. Hamas says it would take significant efforts and special equipment to recover the remaining bodies from the destruction in Gaza. Meanwhile, Cardinal Pier Battista Pizzaballa has given an update on the status of Christians in Gaza. We are in daily contact with them, the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem said of the Catholic community in Gaza in a Vatican News interview. They keep writing that they still cannot believe they were able to sleep through the night without hearing the sounds of bombs. Despite the promising outcome of the first phase of the peace deal, which saw the return of Israeli hostages and the strategic withdrawal of IDF troops from Gaza, Pizzaballa emphasized that the situation in Gaza remains very fluid. Amid de-escalation between Israel and Hamas forces, clashes among warring factions have broken out across Gaza. The situation remains dramatic because everything is destroyed, he explained. People are returning, but they are returning to the ruins. Hospitals are not functioning, and schools do not exist. Congressional maps across the U.S. could be impacted by a Supreme Court hearing on Wednesday. Mark Mayfield has the story.
Justices heard arguments over whether Louisiana's new House map violates the Constitution. The 2024 map created a second majority black congressional district after black voters sued, arguing the old map violated the Voting Rights Act because they were being underrepresented. The state's attorney general says the part of the Voting Rights Act that prohibits racial discrimination in redistricting is unconstitutional. I'm Mark Mayfield.
Bank of America and the Bank of New York Mellon are being sued for allegedly knowingly providing financial services that enabled Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking operation. They're being sued by a woman who said she was abused by the late sex criminal. The suit filed Wednesday alleges that the plaintiff met Epstein in 2011, became financially dependent on him, and was abused at least 100 times. She claims that she was employed on paper by a sham company and told to open a Bank of America account in which money was regularly deposited. The Bank of New York is accused of providing credit to a modeling agency Epstein used to traffic victims. President Trump is killing the multi-billion-dollar Gateway Rail Tunnel project in New York. Scott Pringle reports.
The project, which has already started, will add a commuter rail tunnel underneath the Hudson River between northern New Jersey and Manhattan. President Trump with a surprise announcement on Wednesday.
Project in New York, it's billions and billions of dollars that Schumer has worked 20 years to get. It's terminated. Tell him it's terminated.
New York Democratic Senator and Minority Leader Chuck Schumer responded, saying Gateway is the most important infrastructure project in America, and that Trump trying to kill it again is pure spite and stupidity. It's unclear if Trump took formal action to remove federal grant funding for the project. Scott Pringle, NBC News Radio, New York.
The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops will select a new president and vice president during its fall plenary assembly, which is set for November 10th through November 13th in Baltimore. In November, the three-year terms for the current president, Archbishop Timothy B. Broglio, and Vice President Archbishop William E. Laurie are set to expire. The new conference leaders, who will be chosen from a slate of 10 candidates, will also serve three-year terms. After the president is chosen, the vice president will be elected from the remaining nine. Measles cases continue to rise across the U.S. Jim Roop has more.
Cases are at a record high in the United States. The U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention says there have been an average of 27 new cases each week since the end of August. So far this year, the CDC says there have been 44 outbreaks. There were just 16 all of last year. The annual total is now above 1,500, the highest since measles was declared eliminated in the U.S. in 2000. I'm Jim Roop.
Instagram is putting guardrails on what teens can see on its app. Instagram CEO Adam Mosseri was on the Today Show to explain.
What we're announcing today is that we've revamped all of our guidelines about what teens can and cannot see on Instagram in a way that is guided by the PG-13 rating that was pioneered by the movie industry.
Mosseri says using the PG-13 rating as a guide, teens will be limited as to what sexualized content or other similar matter deemed appropriate they can see. The changes apply only to teen-specific accounts. He also says the new guardrails won't be perfect.
You will occasionally come across content that it might be risky because we either missed it or because it was said by a friend. But generally, there is a lot more restrictions on what you can see.
Other apps, such as YouTube, have also rolled out similar methods to restrict inappropriate content to teens. The J.M. Smucker Company is taking Trader Joe's to federal court, Michael Kastner reports.
We were torn apart at birth.
That's dramatic.
This is the story of the best part of the sandwich and his crust.
Smucker is filing suit against the grocery chain over concerns that Trader Joe's new frozen peanut butter and jelly sandwiches are too close in design and appearance to Smucker's Uncrustables. Smucker suggests that even the box that the Trader Joe's sandwiches come in is similar to theirs. Smucker wants restitution and all of the Trader Joe's packaging and sandwiches to be destroyed.
So I said, no, you're the one who's jelly.
Yeah, hilarious.
I'm Michael Kastner.
And did St. Hildegard von Bingen invent pumpkin spice? Well, not exactly, but she did talk about the ability of cinnamon to brighten a bad mood and praises the ingredients of nutmeg and cloves for their warmth. That's a lot of what we want out of our pumpkin spice today. Well, there's still lots to come here on Catholic Connection. In fact, Teresa will be back talking with Michael New next. And it's all about abortion rates declining, which is good news. And Katrin Bennett will be here talking about a new book, Holier Matrimony. And then I'll be back at the end of the show to talk about a case of a pro-lifer who was attacked while filming an interview. So a lot more happening. Stay tuned. The Catholic Connection.
And we're back here on Catholic Connection. Connecting with Michael New, Assistant Professor of Social Research at the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America. And he's joining us. He is a regular guest of Ave Maria, of EW10 and Teresa Tamio. And Michael, always a pleasure to talk with you. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. I much appreciate it.
So, Michael, let's talk about this new estimate abortion decline in 2025 and an article you penned. So give us an overview of this.
Sure. From time to time, the Guttmacher Institute releases updated data on abortion, and they came out with some new data for the first 6 months of 2025, and they found some good news for pro-lifers. The number of abortions has declined by about 5% since the previous year, so that's a good thing. The main reason for this decline is largely the Florida Heartbeat Act. On May 1st, 2024, Florida enacted a law that protects preborn children after 6 weeks gestation And that's had a big impact. It's protected pre-born children in Florida, also other states. Women in states like Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana are often going to Florida to obtain abortions because laws there used to be more permissive, but they can't do that anymore. So it's saving unborn children in Florida, saving the pre-born in other southern states. That's playing a big, big role. That said, you know, I'm telling pro-lifers to be a bit cautious. Guttmacher does not give a comprehensive count of telehealth abortions. You know, that post-Dobbs, women can obtain chemical abortions through the mail. And their data on that may not be completely accurate. So while there's some good news here, I think we have to take this with a little bit of grain of salt.
So what do we attribute this to, and why should we take it with a grain of salt? Just to elaborate a little bit more, but what do we attribute this to?
Well, again, if you look at the overall decline, you see declines in a lot of states. California, New York, Massachusetts all saw slight declines. You saw the biggest decline in Florida because, again, the Heartbeat Act, which protects the preborn after 6 weeks gestation, and it protects the preborn in Florida and other southern states. And again, women in nearby states that sometimes obtain abortions in Florida because the laws there were previously more permissive. When it comes to, you know, these telehealth abortions, again, you know, tragically, you know, women who want to obtain chemical abortions can do so online. You know, they can go and get an online health consultation, and a doctor can prescribe the abortion pill, and they can obtain this pill through the mail. And these telehealth abortions are undermining a lot of the good pro-life laws that we are passing. So a lot of the counts you see from different groups, you know, they try to count telehealth abortions, but since it's unregulated, there's a good chance those numbers may not be completely accurate. So, you know, we need better data, but more importantly, we need to stop these telehealth abortions. You know, letting women obtain chemical abortions without an in-person medical exam is fatal to unborn children, but terrible public health for women. I mean, if a woman is in a complex pregnancy that obtains an abortion, that can be fatal. If a woman is further along the gestation and obtains the chemical abortion, that can have some very negative serious health consequences. So pro-lifers have our work cut out for us.
Okay, and what do we do then, Michael? Where do we go from here when you said we have to stop these types of abortions? How do we do that as lay people listening here on the show?
Well, there's a couple of things at place. I mean, first, there are some state attorney general that are working on this. For instance, I mean, I would argue that a lot of these telehealth abortions are illegal. If a woman in Texas, you know, has an online consultation with a New York physician, that New York physician should not be allowed to prescribe her a chemical abortion pill. That New York physician is licensed to practice medicine in New York, not Texas. So you have the state attorneys general that are trying to prosecute these out-of-state doctors. We'll see how that goes. But here's the good news. The Trump administration can stop this tomorrow. The reason why we have telehealth abortions is because of the pandemic. During the pandemic, the FDA changed its rules, and they started allowing women to get these abortions online. The Biden administration continued this unwise policy, which the Trump administration inherited. They could change this tomorrow. The fact they're delaying is frustrating to pro-lifers. We just have to keep the issue salient. We have to let the Trump administration know this is important to us. We want to see prompt, quick action. So we just have to keep the issue alive. I mean, they are doing a review of chemical abortion pills at HHS. That's a positive development. They could be doing a lot more, a lot faster.
So, Michael New, what is stopping, in your opinion, the Trump administration from stopping this practice?
That's a very good question. You know, government works slowly. You know, I do think you have some career appointees at HHS and FDA that may not be sympathetic to Donald Trump and some people, you know, in his administration. You know, I think that Trump, to be honest, there are people on Trump's team who think it might cause a political backlash. You know, I think there are some people, you know, who work for President Trump who are very pro-life, but there are some people who aren't. And I think some of his advisors think that putting some limits, protections on chemical abortions might hurt him politically. I think that's causing some issues. So I don't know what's running around the head of anybody's mind, but, you know, pro-lifers are an important part of his coalition. We have some political leverage. We just have to keep this issue salient at the forefront.
So, Michael, who are the people, including yourself, like, who are the people that would put pressure on the administration to get them to change this if they could do it today? I mean, where do we go from there? And who are the type of people that would put pressure on the administration?
I mean, the Beltway pro-life groups are working hard on this issue. It's certainly something we care about. Groups like Susan B. Anthony, Pro-Life America, and National Right to Life and Students for Life and Americans United for Life. I mean, we are engaged on this issue, but we need, you know, frankly, Beltway groups are great, but we just need ordinary people to do their role too. I mean, people can write to the president. They can write to HHS. They can write to the FDA. I mean, we just need to make it clear this is a priority. You know, pro-life groups by ourselves can't do much good. The reason why we have power is because, you know, people support us. So it's not, you know, pointy-headed people in Washington. It's the grassroots. So we really need people to get engaged, call the White House, write to the White House, get letters sent in. You know, we just need to let people, the administration, know that this is a priority.
You know, that's a great point, Michael, to give our listeners tools on what they can do. Because oftentimes people feel hopeless and helpless. They're like, oh, you know, there's nothing I can do. But you can do something. So maybe you get a group of people together, and it would it be effective if there's a ton of people signing the same letter in maybe a community or a church group or a pro-life group in their community or hometown? I mean, can you walk them through the steps? This may be something so new to people listening that they didn't realize they could do anything at all.
Sure. Getting a group of people to sign a letter is always effective. You know, once elected officials see a group together, they know that, you know, there's people communicating with each other and that concerns them. So, sure. I mean, you know, I think that the pro-life movement is going to start to make it a little bit easier for people to interface with the administration. You know, I do see online petitions being circulated. You know, I do see events happening in the near future to raise the status of this issue. You know, again, we're grateful that RFK Jr. is doing a review of these chemical abortion pills, but we need more faster. So I think, again, we'll be in touch with, you know, local pro-life groups. People can still do things on their own. They can collect petitions at church. They can, you know, email the White House. They can call the White House. You know, there are, you know, comment lines available. You know, people need to take advantage of those things.
You know, Michael, we have about a minute left with you, and I know you made note that, you know, pro-lifers shouldn't look, it's positive, but at the same time, there's a lot of work still to be done. How does the other side look at this decline, in your opinion?
That's a good question. I mean, I think they obviously are against the Florida Heartbeat Act. You know, they did try to put a ballot proposition that would put legal abortion in Florida's constitution. They failed, but they're trying to undermine pro-life laws elsewhere. You know, they realize laws have some impact. There may be another ballot question in Florida in the future. That wouldn't surprise me. There's ballot questions elsewhere. So whenever we win, they do push back. So you know, we always have to be wary. Even though Florida is a conservative state, you know, they're going to put money in these ballot propositions, and we need to be concerned and prepared.
Holier Matrimony, Married Saints, Catholic Vows, and Sacramental Grace, the book available at the EWTN Religious Catalog. And to talk about that is our next guest, the author, Katrin Bennett. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Vanessa.
I'm pronouncing that right, correct? Katrin?
Yes, Katrin,
okay.
Yes.
Katrin. So, Katrin, tell us what inspired you to write this book.
Well, I really became friends with some saints back in college and as a young adult. And then I got married and I realized that all the saints that I was learning about, or almost all of them, were religious or single. And I needed some married saints to be, you know, my friends and my inspiration for my marriage and my vocation. So I started learning more about them, and that's how this book came to be.
So who's your particular target audience?
I would say I definitely wrote the book mostly for engaged couples, because I think it's so important that we're able to come into our marriage understanding already what kind of commitment we're making and what the vows mean that we're taking. That's a big part of this book, that we don't just say the vows, that one day we learn them and then we live them out every day. But anybody who is married could definitely benefit from the book. A lot of your listeners have probably been married a lot longer than I have, but luckily, this book is not Marriage According to Katrin and Chris Bennett. This is Marriage According to the Catholic Church. So it's a lot more than just 9 years of marriage advice. We've got 2,000 years here.
So, Katrin, I love the fact that you recognized a gap, you know, something that was missing and for a particular group of people. And you've solved that problem. You filled that gap. You know, why would readers benefit from this book?
I think having friends in heaven who got there by the same vocational path that you did is really inspiring, and it's practically really helpful, because you can learn how they lived out their life and their marriage, and then you can try to imitate that in your own marriage. And then also those saints are going to be praying for you, which is obviously really powerful and helpful to your marriage also. And then learning the vows, like I said, will help you to be a better spouse. This is your job description, are the vows of the marriage that we take as Catholics. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. If you want to be a better wife, just look back at your vows and say, okay, I'm going to find a way to love my husband more freely today. What does that look like? I'm going to find a way to love my wife more in sickness and in health today. And how can I do that? So you don't have to make that up yourself. You can look at what the church is giving you in those vows.
Hmm. I love that. What great examples for us. And, you know, I have friends in the saint world as well. Many saints are my friends. I lean on them all the time. And marriage is a journey. You know, there's ups and downs. And we know this, whether you've been married a year or, you know, 10 years, 50 years, there's ups and downs, you know. And so we all need support. We all need each other. And why not lean on the saints and look at their lives and how they went through some of their own struggles? So what stories of some saint couples from the book can you share with us, or are you most excited to share with our listeners today? Maybe a couple stories?
Well, obviously, I'm pretty attached to all of them. That's why I chose the ones that I did.
Yeah.
But probably the chapter that I'm most excited about is a couple that died in the Rwandan genocide in 1994. Mm. So recently. Their names are the Servants of God, Cyprian and Daphrose Rugamba. Mm. And they were really inspiring to me, you know, as a more modern married couple, and they had a bunch of kids, really beautiful family, but also because they're such a good example of healing within a marriage, that they had a lot of trials and tribulation at the beginning of their marriage, and the man, Cyprian in particular, was pretty spiritually ill before the marriage and in the first few years of the marriage, and his wife just prayed for him constantly, prayed for their children, and he ended up converting and also kind of being miraculously healed from a physical illness at the same time. And then they were able to work together and effect so much greater change together in a time when their country really needed voices for peace and unity. And they brought that, and ultimately they gave their lives for that.
Hmm. Wow, what a beautiful story. And that is in many of our lifetimes. So that's like right here, something we can read about. And I remember covering the Rwanda genocide and talking about it, and these are stories that you might not have heard about, right?
I'm excited to share their story because people don't know them yet. It's also kind of the most personal story because I was able to interview one of their close personal friends for the chapter,
which
is not the case for people like St. Monica who lived so much longer ago.
Yes. But that's a great example that you can, what was that like for you to interview somebody, the family friends of a couple that you are featuring in this book? What was that experience like for you?
It's so interesting to talk to somebody who really knew those people, you know, in their daily lives. He had stayed at their house when he would visit Rwanda, and actually they called him that morning and said, you know, we hear gunfire outside. He was one of the last people that they talked to. Mm-hmm. And he, even more than me and more than, you know, people who are just reading about them, I'm sure was so inspired by their lives.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned something important about praying for your spouse. You know, I was probably like 4 or 5 years into my marriage until I learned that part of my responsibility, my biggest responsibility, is to get my spouse to heaven. I'm like, really? I didn't know that. And you know, and so let's talk about the Catholic marriage vows and how they're tied to the book and our responsibility as spouses to our spouse.
Yeah, it's a big responsibility to not only work on your own salvational path, but, you know, on your spouse's, that you're responsible for them and for your children, too. The vows are comprehensive. You know, the church gives them to us. We don't get to write our own vows, which was kind of a relief to me. And I kind of took each of those 8 vows, which are to love freely, faithfully, fully, fruitfully, in sickness and in health, for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, until death do us part. That's 8. And I took each of those 8 and gave them either a saint or a couple that I thought really exemplified that vow. So in each chapter, you get to read their biography and then kind of trace that vow through their marriage and their life. And then I give some ideas about today, how you could live that vow out in your own life also.
That's beautiful. What a great example and something to learn from. What last words do you want to share with our listeners about reading this book? You know what? I see this, Katrin, as being a great book for marriage prep. I'm going to tell you that right now. I think this is something
I would love to see that.
Yeah, that would be great. If people are listening and you're running marriage prep, I know a couple of people that run marriage prep here in Michigan and the St. Thomas Chaldean Eparchy and the Chaldean community, and I'm definitely going to recommend this because I think this would be a great book to read in marriage prep as a couple and then talk about it in the group that you're meeting together. That would be wonderful.
Yeah, I agree. And I have discussion questions at the end of each chapter and a prayer that would be really good to use in a group setting. So I definitely designed it for that purpose. And I would love to see programs like Engaged Encounter or Marriage Encounter pick this up as a resource to share with their users.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. So I know it's available at the EWTN Religious Catalog. Who published the book?
Marian Press.
Marian Press. Wonderful. Any last words, Katrin, you want to share with our listeners here on Catholic Connection before we let you go?
Just get married in the Catholic Church, learn your vows, and keep living them out every day, and let your marriage be an example of Christ's love for the church.
Thank you so much, Katrin, for being with us and sharing your book, Holier Matrimony, Married Saints, Catholic Vows, and Sacramental Grace, available at the EWTN Religious Catalog, a great place to find great Christmas gifts. Thank you for being with us. God bless you and all that you do.
Thank you so much.
Stay with us, everyone. Joan Lewis is going to be with us after the break.
Welcome back to Catholic Connection. I am Sherry Brownrigg and for Teresa Tamio, and thanks to Vanessa Denha-Garmo for those great interviews that you just heard here on EWTN Radio Extra. By the way, one of our great EWTN radio partners needs to hear from you next week. The Rock Catholic Radio, with three stations serving Cleveland and Northern Ohio, kicks off their Fall Spirit Drive next Wednesday. And please support your local Catholic station because they do need you. We have with us right now Chris Ferrara, and he's senior counsel at Thomas More Society. Chris, welcome to Catholic Connection.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, we're really happy to have you here as well. And we want to talk about a particular situation where a Catholic pro-lifer, Savannah Craven Anteo, was physically attacked on the streets of New York. So I guess the very first question is, what actually happened?
Well, Savannah is a pro-life advocate whose mission includes sidewalk discussions on the pro-life issue, attempting to persuade people to the pro-life position.
So which she goes out and does,
yeah, and she does, woman on the street, man on the street type interviews, which are recorded. On this particular day, her husband was recording the sidewalk interview, and she was having an interview with this particular person. And in the course of the discussion, which went on for several minutes, Savannah said something that the other person didn't like. So this other person decided to punch her in the face repeatedly with the right hand and then with the left hand, which had a cell phone in it, causing her to, according to Savannah, to sustain stitches, and she had to go to the emergency room. She ended up with $3,000 in medical bills. And this is pretty much emblematic of a phenomenon we see arising on the left, which is that their reaction to opinions they don't like is violence. Of course, the Charlie Kirk assassination is the most dramatic example of that. And the near assassination of President Trump. There's even a study out of Rutgers University which freely admits, having looked at incidents of the last few years, that this is a left-wing phenomenon. And the study refers to it as an assassination culture. And we see this rhetoric all over the left, from political leaders in the Democrat Party, from street activists and so forth, to the effect that people they oppose should simply be killed or otherwise physically injured.
In this particular case, so it was taken to court, but now the assailant is not going to face charges. Is that correct?
Well, here we see a related phenomenon, which is the double standard of justice. Yeah. So let's imagine that Savannah had been a pro-choice activist, as they call themselves. We're pro-choice, pro-abortion. And she was making a pitch for Planned Parenthood, interviewing a pro-lifer on the sidewalk, and the pro-lifer punched her in the face repeatedly. Well, that pro-lifer would be sitting in jail right now. It's obvious that there was a double standard at work here. So District Attorney Bragg's office bungled the case. They assigned it to someone who was not even admitted to the bar yet under a special rule that allows law school graduates to handle cases. And this was a nationally publicized case. The assault took place on video. It was open and shut. It should have been charged as a felony assault. Instead, it was downgraded to a misdemeanor, and then the person they let handle the case allowed the discovery deadline to lapse, and the case was dismissed on speedy trial grounds. But it doesn't end there, because there was an opportunity to bring a felony charge under a longer period of time to make discovery. The deadline then would have been 6 months instead of 90 days. We wrote to Bragg's office and pointed out that he could still bring a felony charge and also a related hate crime charge because the violent assault was motivated by Savannah's pro-life and Christian religious views. And we got a response from Bragg's office to the effect that they will not prosecute. So the double standard is obvious.
It's interesting that you use the hate crimes defense because, you know, we so often see that towards different groups, transgender, LGBTQ, whatever, but it doesn't seem to be very effective, does it, when we use it, if it is applied to someone's religious beliefs? What's going on there?
Well, you're getting at the root of the problem, and the root of the problem in civil society today is precisely what you're suggesting here, which is a bias against Christians. Mm-hmm. And the death of Charlie Kirk has activated a large segment of the population that now recognizes that ultimately this is all about Christ and the reign of Christ the King. You have politicians now on the right speaking about Christ publicly for the first time. So there's an inherent bias in the system. So if you burn a Quran, that's a hate crime. But if you burn a Bible, that's free speech. It's obviously a double standard, and that's the reason for it. It's all about enmity toward Christ and the law of the gospel, and this is the basic problem of modern civilization, a civilization that is descending into barbarism and literal insanity, as we see with the transgender movement and other such phenomena.
Well, you know, we all know who's behind this kind of violence. I mean, it's, you know, it's just evil, pure and simple. But Satan does a really good job of turning things upside down for us and making it seem like it's a good or tolerant or whatever. And, you know, it's simply sin. And when we go in the face of that, evil will react. And you're seeing that with this kind of violence. And it clearly is on the rise, isn't it?
Yeah, as I indicated earlier, there's actually a couple of studies out, one of them from Rutgers University, freely admitting, and this is, you know, legitimate sociological research, this is now a left-wing phenomenon. And why is it happening? Well, because the left sees a turnabout to the extent that it's possible in this particular political climate. People are waking up to the reality that what these people are proposing on the left is simply insane. It defies common sense. It's a war on being itself, a denial that there are men and women and that God created them as male and female. So this war on being is reflected in what we see on the streets and in what happened to Savannah. That's the essence of the problem.
Wow. You know, just pausing to think about that, that's a very dangerous place for us to be as a society, that now, because the truth is coming out, those who do not want the truth to see the light of day will react, and so we have to be ready for that. What other types of... Oh, go ahead.
This was predicted long ago by Pope Leo XIII in his encyclical on liberty.
Indeed it was, yeah. Tell us more.
He said that if you allow free reign to truth and error and let them contend for allegiance in the public square, and you don't put any restraints on evil opinions, ultimately evil opinions will become the norm, and the correct opinions, the morally correct positions will become, as we see now, hate speech. And you'll be called a fascist, and you'll be punched in the face, as Savannah was.
So or assassinated.
What do we do now?
I mean, you continue to speak the truth. You keep the faith. Gosh, Savannah's quite courageous. I wonder whether it's even sensible and prudent for her to go back out on the sidewalk, because someone else now will see her as a target. But she's going to do it because she has a lot of courage. And this is my privilege as an attorney to represent people who literally put their bodies on the line. They will go to jail. They will suffer physical assault. They will even risk assassination, which is what happened to Charlie Kirk, to speak the truth in the public square. And it's my privilege to defend these people. I'm on the sidelines. They're the ones that deserve all the praise.
You have defended a lot of different people. And what are some of the wins that you've had? So we need a little good news in here.
Well, there have been a number of victories where pro-lifers were accused, for example, of contempt for violating an injunction, and proceedings are conducted, and the abortion clinics send in witnesses who exaggerate or outright lie, and the contempt motions in three different cases I can think of were defeated. Court found no contempt of court. So this is a constant battle against forces on the left who lie their way through legal proceedings, and you have to expose their lies. And there have been other victories that we've had. We had, for example, during the COVID era in the state of California, we successfully sued Governor Newsom and got an injunction reopening the churches. And thereafter, he settled. We also got an injunction striking down certain restrictions, COVID restrictions imposed by Governor Cuomo by a judge in the Northern District of New York. And that injunction was never overturned. And finally, Cuomo's restrictions were abandoned. So there are victories to be had, and the key thing is the landscape, the legal landscape has changed, because now you have full-time professionals devoted to this kind of pro-life and pro-First Amendment defense for Catholics and other Christians.
Yeah,
it's now, we're now fighting on equal footing. It's no longer volunteers who have private practices and try to devote part of their time. We have dedicated national public interest law firms who are fight for the rights of pro-life advocates, Catholics and other Christians in the public sphere.
And that is a good thing to be celebrated. Yeah, that's amazing. Well, let's go back to this particular case of Savannah Craven and Teo. So this is on video. I'm thinking about the district attorney's office just dismissing all of it. He can see the video. What was his defense in saying that there's no merit to this case?
Well, he didn't say there was no merit. There was an apology because whoever they had handle it was not yet admitted to the bar. Basically, it was an intern who just graduated from law school. According to their explanation, he fumbled the case, missed the discovery deadline, and it was dismissed on speedy trial grounds. So there was an apology. Was it a sincere apology? Well, all I can tell you is that when we offered them the opportunity, based on our legal research, to refile as a felony, yeah, they declined it. So they could apologize all they would like to, but the bottom line is, when they had the chance to bring a prosecution that would have been appropriate, a felony assault, they declined to do so. And that speaks volumes.
Yeah, it does speak volumes, yeah. And the fact that it sounds like it was a simple decline and no other words with it. No, I don't think we'll do that. That's amazing. Well, you are so right, too, that Savannah Craven and Teo, you know, if she goes back out, because that video went viral in a lot of different places.
It's international, not just the United States.
Yeah.
In fact, I believe she was interviewed by Sky TV in Australia. So that just went literally to the other side of the world.
Does she have any other recourse at this point?
Yes. As we've indicated in press releases, we're going to bring a civil action against the assailant, and that action will obviously be seeking not just compensatory damages but punitive damages, because the conduct was outrageous. I should note that after she committed the assault and battery, this woman walked away with both middle fingers extended in triumph, and since then she's been gloating about her quote unquote accomplishment on her social media. And she's getting comments like, you didn't hit her hard enough, or you go, girl, you did the right thing. And this is the whole mentality we're dealing with.
Wow.
The left is involved in a kind of violent infantilism. If they hear something they don't like a little child, but with often deadly force, they react violently to what they don't like to hear. It's a dangerous phenomenon. We're dealing literally with
violent children in adult bodies. And this is what claimed the life of Charlie Kirk, this young man who assassinated him.
Yeah.
Thought it was his right to take out the, quote, fascists. And the mentality that resulted in his assassination is the same mentality that resulted in Savannah being assaulted on the sidewalk. They think violence is justified. That's simple.
Right. And there are national polls that are showing that that is the case. Christopher Ferrara, and we so appreciate it, of the St. Thomas More Society. Thank you so much for being with us today. And thank you for doing what you are doing, because it is so incredibly necessary. And my friends, don't go away. We've got a little bit more left on Catholic Connection. To Catholic Connection, Sherry Brownrigg in for Teresa Tomeo. Vanessa will be in tomorrow, and she'll have the inside word with Doug Keck. And Joseph Pierce is here. He will be here anyway. Great Books for Good Men, talking about that tomorrow. What a great show today. So much for us to learn about and to pray about. And, you know, I'm energized. I'm energized to go out there and be courageous after talking with Christopher Ferrara to really proclaim Christ and to also fight for our unborn children. My goodness. You know what? There is no better cause. There is no better cause. So if you want to read about that, it's at National Catholic Register, by the way. And, you know, we're coming up on Advent. I know it's just October, but we are thinking about this already. And there's a crystal Advent rosary that is gorgeous, that is available right now at the EWTN Religious Catalog. And it's a gorgeous rosary called the Crystal Advent Rosary. You have to go find it and read about it. And one other note I want to tell you is that Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis comes up Saturday, 5 a.m., 9:30 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. And Joan is in the Eternal City, of course. She'll speak with Vatican officials and visitors about events that are affecting the church and the world. And in the meantime, a lot to pray for. And I hope that your day, your weekend, the rest of your week is blessed, that it is grace-filled, and you open yourself up to the Lord and let Him lead you, because, my friends, that is the only life that we can lead. God bless.